I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written, by many measures, commonsensical or statistical, the U.S. has not been more divided politically or economically in the last 100 years than it is now. How have we gone from the striking bipartisan cooperation and relative economic equality of the war years and post-war period to the extreme inequality and savage partisan divisions of today? Our guest this hour is Professor Doug McAdam, professor of sociology at Stanford University and former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, author or co-author of many books with a special emphasis on race in the U.S., American politics, and the study of social movements and contentious politics. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Doug McAdam. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. He is the co-author of Deeply Divided, and we have a lot to talk about this hour. Professor McAdam, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, a great pleasure to have you here. So how do you explain it? Let me just throw that first paragraph back to you. How do you explain extreme inequality and the savage partisan divisions of today? What happened?
I mean, it's a complicated story.
Yes.
But, I mean, the main storylines that we kind of emphasize in the book, the big one is the kind of shifting what we call the racial geography of American politics. Prior to the 1960s, we had a very stable system in place from the Civil War till, again, 1960, where the South was aligned with the Democrats because of this traditional historic enmity toward the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party. And that allowed Democrats to kind of dominate federal policymaking in the mid 20th century, when Kennedy and then Johnson, even more aggressively in the 60s, began to advocate for civil rights reform, angered the southern wing of the party, the white South anyway, got over its traditional hatred of the party of Lincoln and started voting Republican, and over a period of time, that redefined politics in the U.S., with the Democrats shifting sharply left and the Republicans shifting sharply right around this sort of fundamental shift in the regional and racial geography of American politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the parties have been moving apart ever since, with race as a central kind of pivot point.
And you have written, and let's talk about this some, indeed a growing body of evidence suggesting that, if anything, the influence of old-fashioned racism has grown considerably since our president, Barack Obama, took office.
Yeah, I mean, and this isn't research I've done, but there's a really substantial body of work, mostly by political scientists, that show sort of an increasing influence of race in American politics. And, you know, when Obama was elected, I think there were many people who imagined we were entering kind of a post-racial period in U.S. politics, and that has not happened, needless to say.
Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about race being front and center in American politics, racism, what does that mean? That we don't elect people who are of a different color? That we don't – what does it mean?
Well, I mean principally what it means, I set racism aside, just talk about the influence of race. The Republicans, by moving sharply right over the last 30, 40 years and assuming more conservative positions on lots of issues, they become very, very dependent on white votes. 90% of those who cast ballots for Mitt Romney were white, as opposed to 60% who voted for Obama. We know that the demography of America is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
The white percent of the population is declining. So Republicans are increasingly dependent on those white votes. There's a kind of demographic noose tightening around the Republican Party. And there's been a fairly systematic campaign to try to restrict the franchise two traditional Democratic constituencies, including racial and ethnic minorities. So race is central to sort of the divisions in American politics today, and in the efforts of both parties to try to get their constituencies out. Those constituencies look very different demographically.
So what happens, and it's already true in so many cities in this country where you have majority-minority populations, what happens to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party once the minority are majorities all over the country?
Well, I mean, that's one of the key questions. We talk about it towards the end of the book. I see two scenarios, two possible scenarios. If the Republicans remain as deeply divided as they are right now, I mean, there's real conflict in the Republican Party. If the party remains divided and by default very extreme, then over some period of time, relatively short period of time, I think the demography, the shifting demography, will mean the Democrats will move back into a kind of dominant position politically. That could take 6 to 8 to 10 years, but that's one scenario. The other, which I'd prefer to see, would be for sort of establishment Republicans to slowly move the party, to kind of bring party discipline or discipline back to the party, move the party back in a more centrist direction, creating more of a basis for the kind of bipartisanship we saw in the post-war period. You know, I'm not overly optimistic, but that would be better for the country as a whole than the kind of paralyzed gridlock state we're in right now.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you wrote this or one of the first hour guests wrote this, that when you look at a list of our concerns as we go into midterm elections, a large measure of concern, which is kind of unusual, is that we're tired of nobody doing anything, that it's gridlock. It's not health care. It's not ISIS. I mean, it is, but it's really gridlock.
Absolutely. I mean, for the first time ever in U.S. history, well, at least since they've been asking this question, which is about 60 years, more than that, 70, 80 years, pollsters ask, what do you see as the most important problem confronting the country? And sometime in the summer when they asked that, the answer was these divisions, the essentially the dysfunctional state of our politics. Here's a fact, a factoid, which is disturbing. In the post-war period, on average, a session of Congress enacted something like 1,500 pieces of legislation. The last full session of Congress, the 112th, recorded an all-time low in modern history of 283. Jimmy Carter said last summer in a speech that we are no longer a functioning democracy. I think that's something of an exaggeration, but we certainly do not have a functioning legislative branch at the federal level at a time when we're facing unbelievable challenges. This is not healthy.
Yeah. So what does the issue of race and what we've been talking about have to do with extreme inequality?
Well, if that's a complicated linkage, but essentially we became as equal as we've ever been in that post-war period, largely because of the dominance of the Democratic Party in federal policymaking. Democrats dominated federal policymaking for basically four decades, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and the tax and fiscal policies pursued by the Democrats served to make us comparatively equal. The shift in the racial geography of American politics that I mentioned before, not only did it sort of dismantle the New Deal coalition and make Democrats or break apart the kind of Democratic dominance in federal policymaking, it also served as the electoral foundation for a newly ascendant and more conservative Republican Party in the last 40, 50 years. That party's fiscal and tax policies have, in fact, widened the gap, economic gap in this country.
And do you have fears? Some have suggested that when we look at a historical comparison, it was on the eve of a Great Depression. Do you worry about the consequences and what might they be of this kind of great inequality?
I don't see a Great Depression looming on the horizon. I just think the extent of these divisions politically and economically make us a weaker country, period. You know, both parties seem to look back at that post-war period with real fondness. It was a very prosperous period in American life. It was a period where we were, again, comparatively equal in economic terms. The two parties were rather close together, and that created a basis for lots of bipartisan cooperation. And Congress was a kind of legislative engine at that point, passing lots of consequential legislation. Americans in general trusted the government, gave the government high marks. Across the board, it was a pretty positive period in U.S. history. These divisions and the magnitude of those divisions sort of are the antithesis of the post-war period. It's not healthy for the country as a whole, economically or politically.
You talk about perhaps to build a viable political middle, we need to establish a third party that appeals to the large number of moderate centrist Americans who don't really believe in the Democrats or in the Republicans. Do you really think that's a possibility?
Well, we don't push that. We say that's, you know, that might be a response to the current situation. It's, you know, third party efforts have not had a great track record in this country, although some have in fact achieved success. The Republican Party was essentially a third party coming out of the abolition movement. I think it's not, you know, I wouldn't say there's high odds that would happen. I think it would require certain very well-respected kind of centrist figures to spearhead the effort. At one point, former Mayor Bloomberg, you know, mayor of New York, was at least talking or exploring that idea. It would take figures of that kind of stature and more than just one. It is really clear from survey evidence that a large percentage of Americans are very unhappy with the current state of affairs and, you know, potentially would gravitate towards a centrist third party, but it would take a sustained mobilizing effort, and that's a big uphill task.
We welcome phone calls. Doug McAdam is our guest. He's a professor of sociology at Stanford University and co-author of Deeply Divided, Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. We started the show, and let me ask you the very same question. Why is it that the United States is so divided politically and economically? In fact, it's as much as it has been 100 years ago. We went through a period, our guest will say, war, post-war, of cooperation and relative economic equality and of the war years and also the post-war years. So how do you go from that to the inequality and incredible partisanship that we have now? What is it? Here's our number again, 800-486-8655. We'll start taking your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Doug McAdam. He is co-author of Divided, Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. And we start our calls with Darlene in Lincoln County. Hi, Darlene.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Darlene.
I can barely hear you.
Well, we hear you.
Yeah, I called in the last hour, and I heard a little bit about your guests talking about partisanship. And I wondered, so many people, family loyalty, all Republicans, all Democrats, or they're looking at the ads. What if you eliminated parties and people got to listen to the content of the campaign speeches and went by what they heard? versus actual parties. What would happen then?
Well, I think we'd obviously have a very different situation. In point of fact, when the country, in the early decades of after the founding of the country, parties were thought to be a bad thing and were kind of actively discouraged, but they are an efficient way to try to organize and mobilize constituencies around, you know, different points of view. I think we would have a very different situation if in fact there weren't parties actively structuring our politics. And again, there's survey evidence right now that the majority of Americans are dissatisfied and don't strongly identify with either of the two major parties. But again, they're the only game in town, so they have this powerful structuring effect.
Thank you very much, Darlene, for your call. It's hard to imagine things being run differently. I mean, so many people are invested in a structure the way that it is.
Absolutely.
The way we advertise, the way we select candidates, all of that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how you would change it to what Darlene suggested. Do you know?
No, I mean, I really don't think you could. I don't think we could pull that off. There, as you say, there are so many interest vested in the current system that I couldn't imagine a scenario under which we would sort of outlaw parties and each individual would be on their own to assess issues and to vote accordingly. Yeah.
Tricia in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm kind of thinking along the same lines as her. We're really dissatisfied with the people we have running. I think the primary system is really where we have it broken. You go and you vote for the most Republican or the most Democratic candidate that aligns with you. If you could set up the primary system nationwide to vote for both sides, you go to the primaries and you vote your favorite of either party, and you put in two votes, and you're going to push each of those parties towards the center as they can't just pander to their very far left or right constituents.
Yeah, that's a very smart point. And here's where some kind of reform might be possible. The primaries really are a big part of the story we try to tell in the book. That is, anytime you have small turnout elections, and primaries are a classic case in point, you basically really increase the influence of the kind of mobilized and typically non-representative wings of the two parties. So we saw this in 2012 in the Republican presidential primaries where, the candidates kind of competed to make the most extreme statements because they were really playing to the extreme Republican base, because typically in primaries you only get something like 12 to maybe 15-18% turnout. And those who turn out are those who are most ideologically committed to kind of the extreme wing of one of the two parties. That grants an awful lot of influence to a relatively small non-representative slice of the American electorate. But there are other ways, as you suggest, to structure the primaries to sort of encourage more centrist views being expressed through the primary process. And there are certain states that have moved in that direction, and they've had those kinds of effects.
Mm-hmm. What have they done? What have those states done?
Well, they've held open primaries.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Again, anybody can show up. That's part of what's one reform possible, at least for primaries, just as you suggested.
And when did we go to we select the candidates, the primaries are the voters, instead of the parties deciding?
Well, this is a fascinating story and very little known, and it's a critical part of the story we tell. I'll try to do this one briefly. In 1968, people old enough like me to remember the Democratic National Convention in Chicago was a fiasco, needless to say. Lots of violence in the street, battles with police and protesters, etc. And, part of it was the peak of the Vietnam War, and a lot of the anger was over that. But a lot of the anger was over the way – The Democrats that year were selecting a presidential candidate. The candidate turned out to be Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey had not contested a single primary. Gene McCarthy, who was an anti-war candidate, had competed in every primary and under today's rules would have been the nominee. But the primaries then, there were only 15 or so, and they were non-binding. So the anger in the streets was, my God, we went to the primaries and expressed our views and supported this man, and another man who's committed to the war effort and has not competed in a single primary is winding up as the nominee because the party bosses want him as the nominee. Inside the convention, new left activists basically orchestrated a real revolution. They got the convention to pass a resolution establishing a commission that was going to review the way that nominations were handled and suggest reforms. They then staffed that very commission and pushed through a set of reforms that created our binding primary system that we know today. That was a victory, kind of a more democratic way to do things, but it's had this ironic effect, again, of granting enormous influence to non-representative, ideologically non-representative slices of the two parties. And it's sort of, basically marginalized the median voter. It's made the center of our political distribution less influential than it once was. Hmm.
Tricia, thanks very much for the call. We go next to Pete in Rhinelander. Hi, Pete.
Yes, hello, Kathleen. I want to do a couple things. One, I have to just add to what the speaker just said, that one of the reasons that Eugene McCarthy was supposedly the front runner at that convention because Bobby Kennedy had just been assassinated. And I think he was going to be the nominee, hands down. But
yes.
I really called to say that the third party discussion is really sort of like kissing your sister. Mike McCabe, author of Blue Jeans in High Places, which has been on your show, Kathleen, has pointed out a path for what can be done. And in his book, why it said it's either the first party or the fourth door. Change your own party from within, and that can get a lot more momentum a lot faster. Last time it was done was in Wisconsin by a group called the Young Turks when Joe McCarthy was running the state pretty much, or the national image of running the state, and the Young Turks got rid of him. Thank you. I'll take your comments.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks for your interesting comments. Professor?
He's absolutely right. On both counts, that is, Bobby Kennedy, he was assassinated literally an hour or so after he had been declared winner in a California primary in June of 1968, and he had all the momentum in the world and almost certainly would have gone on to be the Democratic standard bearer in 68. When he was killed, it appeared as if Gene McCarthy was the logical person to turn to, but that's not what the party establishment wanted. So he's quite right to underscore that point. And secondly, yes, I absolutely concede that a third party effort is a serious long shot. It is easier, and historically what's happened in these kinds of situations is parties have kind of reformed themselves from within. There are certainly establishment Republicans who would like to see that happen, who recognize the kind of demographic corner they've painted themselves into and would like to move the party at least somewhat back into a more centrist stance and appeal in particular to the growing number of Hispanic voters. There were Republicans in the Senate just last year who worked with Democrats to craft a comprehensive immigration reform bill, sent it on to the House, but that's where the really extreme kind of Tea Party representatives have an effective veto over Republican policy, and that bill has sat ever since. So you see the tension in the Republican Party in the way the Senate and the House engage the issue of immigration reform. It's really interesting.
Doug, let's spend a moment talking about money in politics, because we're just seeing so much money in the midterms, and we've been paying attention to this $20 million a day in the Senate races that we started seeing last week. Do we see more money in campaigns when we have more partisan parties? If you have a more moderate group of candidates from which to select, is there less money supporting them? And what does money have to do with what we're talking about anyhow?
Oh, it has an awful lot to do. In answer to your first question, yes, when things are more extreme, when the parties are more divided, less close together ideologically, yes, more money tends to go into campaigns because these are, you know, the parties are essentially at war, which motivates people to give large sums of money. It's a huge problem, made worse by the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court 18 months ago. We've never seen this kind of money in our political process and in lobbying in Washington in general. There's a wonderful book by Mann and Ornstein, and I'm blanking on the title. It's something like "It's Even Worse Than It Looks" or something. These are two moderate, kind of longtime observers of Congress, and they write about the corrupting effect of money in our politics. There's quite a literature on this, actually, and they also quote any number of elected officials, senators and representatives, who concede that they spend the lion's share of their time simply fundraising. The stakes are that high, and the amount of money that's out there and needs to be mobilized to prevail in a campaign is just off the charts at this point. Mm-hmm. That's another way in which our legislative branch is really gridlocked at this point, around this just almost 24/7 ongoing fundraising effort.
And do you see any potential, and if so, how they would happen, changes to the Citizens United ruling?
With the present constitution of the Supreme Court, no. I think that decision at some point will be reversed. There's always been, even recently, there was a fair amount of bipartisan support for campaign reform, campaign finance reform. We're so far away from that at this point. Essentially, there are no restrictions on fundraising, campaign contributions in this country at this point, and that's an unhealthy situation to be in. I think it will be reversed in time, but again, I don't think it would be reversed by judicial decision as long as the current Supreme Court is in session or is in place.
Pete, thank you very much for your call. We have lines open now if you want to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the U.S. Being more divided politically and economically than it's been in the last 100 years. And the question of the hour, which has been examined fully by our guest, is how we've gone from bipartisan cooperation and relative economic equality of the years of World War II and post-war to what we have now, extreme inequality and savage partisan divisions. And Doug McAdam is our guest. He's a professor of sociology at Stanford University. He's the co-author of a new book, Deeply Divided, Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, and if you like us there, then you can hear about upcoming shows, too, which is nice, so you don't miss something you really want to hear. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. John in Grand Marsh, next caller. Hi, John. Hey, John.
Oh, I'm really intrigued by the idea of changing our primary system, just Patricia Madison and other callers. I kind of believe that we could go to a European model where what they're doing is electing the primary system elects the candidates for the final election. So in that matter, I would think that we'd get a centrist political view for those regional areas versus looking at an overall changing the party system. I'll take your comments out here.
Okay, thank you, John.
I had trouble hearing. It was sort of garbled. I think he was talking about kind of a European primary system that essentially winds up effectively setting the ballot for the general election. That would probably moderate the primary results, I would guess. Although even that's somewhat tricky now. This is another issue we haven't touched on, but it has been a big part of the story, especially in the last 10, 15 years, and that's the extreme gerrymandering mm-hmm. that has transformed the House. As recently as 1998, the modal House district was a swing district. That is, it was fully competitive. I'm not going to get the exact number right, but I want to say something like 170 of the House districts were swing districts. By some counts, we're down to as few as 27. People differ a little bit in how they define a swing district. But essentially, the great majority of House districts are now captured. They're effectively property of one party or the other. In that situation, we really don't have competitive House races anymore. So there wouldn't be that much incentive, even in a European-style primary structure system, to kind of pick moderate centrist candidates, because essentially extreme Republicans or very liberal Democrats are virtually guaranteed election if they're in a district controlled by their party.
Hmm. Well, I'm wondering if anybody's done a study, Doug, of what's happened in those states where they have bipartisan redistricting of congressional areas. Does it make for more moderate candidates? Do we know? It does.
Yep. It does. Huh. And that's a really obvious reform. This is not, to me, a partisan issue. I would guess most Americans, you know, would favor putting redistricting in the hands of a bipartisan commission rather than partisan legislatures. I don't like it when Democrats use GIS, new GIS techniques, ever more sophisticated GIS techniques, to create these weird-looking amoeba-shaped districts simply to enhance the chances of Democrats prevailing in that district. There's something that feels anti-democratic about that, I suspect, to most Americans. That would be a major step forward, is simply to take the redistricting out of the hands of partisan legislatures and create bipartisan commissions to do that work. There's a handful of states that already do that.
And what prompts those states to do that?
I think it's exactly what we're talking about. They recognize that there's something inherently problematic about essentially letting actors who are loyal to a particular party control the redrawing of district boundaries. I mean, it's a time-honored tradition. Both parties have done it. That, to me, is not a justification for continuing a practice that on its face seems anti-democratic.
Thanks, John, for your call. Matt in Sparta. Hi.
Hi there. First, I'd like to say I agree with the speaker on most things he's talked about, gerrymandering and campaign finance reform. All are definitely things we need to see. However, one point that was made was changing the party from within to affect, you know, the kind of ideological things you'd like to see come from either party. However, those of us who'd like to see a strong libertarian party, representative, I guess you could say, it's hard to imagine either party changing to the extent that would make most libertarians happy. I just know it's too much of a shift for both of their ideologies to go support a true libertarian option.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you can't imagine a kind of reform in either of the two major parties, that, especially that move the party in a kind of more centrist direction, that would appeal to true libertarians. You're absolutely right.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. Jim is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. You already touched on gerrymandering, and for the life of me, I don't understand why they don't let the Census Bureau dictate the districts, you know, strictly by topography, geography, and population. Going beyond that, Rusper was relatively successful with a third-party attempt. Had he not gone off the deep end and maintained that party, I think that we would have our third party right now. Beyond that, there are national organizations that I think could be turned into a political party. The Concord Coalition comes to mind, which is a strongly bipartisan group. So there's some ideas there.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for the ideas. Does anybody do that census districting?
The census would not be the appropriate body to do it. I think a commission, with expertise in the area, relying on good census data, is the right approach. The Census Bureau has its work cut out for it, doing what it does. I couldn't imagine saddling the Census Bureau with that kind of responsibility. It would also politicize the Census Bureau in a way that I think would not be healthy for that particular agency.
Mm-hmm.
But again, a bipartisan commission staffed by people who are really expert in the area, relying on accurate census data, would be the appropriate way to go there.
Thank you so much for the call. Diane in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good afternoon. No one ever talks about the caucus restaurant pledge by the Republicans. It never seems to come up on the radio.
The what?
The caucus room restaurant was a meeting by the Republicans.
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. There was a famous dinner on I think it was the night of the inaugural balls in 2008 when Obama took office, where a group of really, kind of senior Republicans gathered and kind of pledged or sort of laid out a strategy for moving forward and regaining power. But I don't know if that's what you're referring to.
I'm referring to the pledge that they would not let Obama have any successes and pass any bills that they didn't like.
I'm not aware of that, but it is certainly the case, and this was essentially part of the strategy that was laid out at this dinner that I'm referring to, is there was just a commitment to a kind of sustained plan to stall pieces of legislation, use filibuster, do everything possible to essentially deny to Obama any real success for his agenda. Mitch McConnell at one point publicly said that his major goal as a minority leader of the Senate was to ensure that Obama would be a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of shocking goal. I mean, that's not substantive. It's simply you're setting out to impede the work of the current sitting president to hopefully engineer a return to power of your party. So I think that was clearly the Republican game plan when Obama took office. The rise of the Tea Party in 2009 aided that agenda immeasurably. And that's precisely why, again, the number of enactments or bills coming out of the Congress these days is at an all-time low, at least in modern U.S. history. It's just the Republicans effectively have created a situation in which meaningful legislation cannot come through Congress.
More phone calls in a moment. Doug McAdam is our guest this hour. He's co-author of Divided: Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. And Diane, thank you for your call. We'll welcome more in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. Tomorrow during this time period, this Wednesday evening at Edgewood College in Madison, a couple who've been working at the U.S.-Mexico border will talk about what they've seen in Arizona with undocumented children who flooded the border earlier this year. So that will be tomorrow during this time period. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Rick in Mosinee. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
You know, that last question comment, I guess, was a good segue to what I asked to ask. But whenever we have these conversations, we always hear, you know, the left is more left liberal, the right conservative, more conservative. And it just seems to me that, you know, the left is trying to hang on to what's left of the New Deal. And, you know, somehow that's, you know, been portrayed as being more left. I guess I'd just like to hear a comment on, you know, how that's, you know, it seems like a false equivalence, I guess, to me.
I think it is a false equivalence. In the book, we talk about the late 60s, early 70s, and we describe that period, 1968 to 72, as sort of the Democrats' Tea Party moment. That is, the new left effectively took over the Democratic Party in that period, 68 to 72. The Democrats were much further to the left in that period than they are now. The Democrats have essentially moved after that, the 72 election where McGovern was absolutely annihilated by Richard Nixon. The Democrats sort of have moved consistently back towards a more centrist direction. There are certainly very liberal Democrats, but there's a pretty full ideological spectrum represented in the Democratic Party these days. That's not the case in the Republican Party.
Thanks very much for the call. Dave on email says, I don't remember gridlock happening under President George Walker Bush. I remember it happening under President Clinton with two shutdowns, and especially now under President Obama. The Democrats didn't have the White House but allowed the government to function under Bush and under Bush Sr. and President Reagan. Isn't this Republican stopping the federal government from functioning when they lose elections?
This is unique. The only slight caveat or the exception to that is that there were periods when George W. Bush was president where there was a concerted effort by Democrats to also stall legislation, misuse, in my view, the filibuster. So there was a little bit of that same kind of extreme partisanship we've seen from the Republicans under Obama, and that we saw by the Republicans, the Republican House with Newt Gingrich as Speaker, with Clinton in the White House. You're quite right. So again, the two parties have not behaved the same when they are effectively out of power, at least not in control of the White House. So the levels of obstruction, legislative hostage taking, kind of misuse of the filibuster during the Obama's presidency are really unprecedented.
Matt in Madison, hello.
Hey, I was calling to find out what the guest's picture of a moderate is, talking about centrist and moderate. And, you know, a lot of times moderates are described for some reason as someone who would support something like the Simpson-Bowles grand bargain cuts to Social Security, when, you know, in reality that's an overwhelmingly unpopular position, but for some reason that's considered moderate. So I was wondering what his research found as to whether
All right.
what people think of as moderate
yeah.
is moderate, or what is the actual
Yeah, it's a good question.
Moderate.
Well, I haven't done research on that question in particular. I mean, to me, a moderate, it really depends on the issue. So, you know, typically on an issue, there'll be a set of policy preferences that, you know, exhibit considerable range from ones that are thought to be more conservative to more liberal. And a moderate is somebody who assumes a more centrist position on that particular issue. So there isn't a single definition of moderate. It really depends on, again, the issue in question.
Well, let me give you an issue. What about trying to get more money for social programs, and so you're trying to change the tax code and taxing substantially more those who are in the upper 1%?
Well, the moderate view, some of this is just statistical. So if you look at survey data, the majority of Americans, in fact, would support a modest increase in the highest tax rates, or the tax rates for the highest earning Americans. That's the moderate view. It hasn't happened. There was a minor little increase, under Obama. But in general, our tax rates have been more or less frozen at a historically relatively low level since Clinton, I think it is, or since Reagan. So a moderate position on that would have us raising taxes, not a whole lot, but a significant increase in the highest tax rates for the highest earning Americans.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. Jay in Two Rivers. Hi.
Good afternoon. I've been interested in politics since I was in middle school, and actually joined one of the political parties and had a seat on the 6th Congressional District Rules and Platform Committee, which was pretty interesting, but eventually quit, realizing nothing was going to change. And actually, my wife and I have been voting mostly third-party independents for the last 35 years.
Oh, my.
And I'd have to agree that it's much worse than what we think it is. And it seems like unless there's some sort of national disaster, we're going to continue down this road. It sure has become apparent how racist this country really is since Obama got elected, and how sexist we still are in Wisconsin since Mary Burke's been running. But I'm wondering why we continue to shift to the right. We've been doing that for 30, 35 years, and our economy and attack on social rights continues to deteriorate, but yet we keep moving to the right. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I find myself generally in agreement with you. It's rather depressing. The book is essentially our attempt to answer it. I think it's a paradox. I think that if you look at public opinion on a wide range of issues, the modal American continues to be fairly centrist in their views. It's when we say the country is polarized, it's not the general public that has polarized. It's the kind of activists within the two parties, and in particular, I would say the Republican Party. And the structure of our system, the particular set of institutions and rules that govern our politics, have granted, inordinate influence to the kind of mobilized wings of the party, and then most recently the Republican Party, and that keeps pushing our policies to the right, even though those policies are out of sync with the public opinion as reflected by the general public. We are in bad shape. Again, when former President Jimmy Carter said we are no longer a functioning democracy, again, I think there's some exaggeration there, but I think the health and well-being of American democracy has not been this weak, arguably, since the run-up to the Civil War. just because we were born a democracy, we can't assume that we are all we will always remain one. I think these are a very worrisome time for a lot of reasons. But unless we can restore the health and well-being of our democratic sort of traditions, we're not going to be in a position to address these major policy challenges that we confront.
And thank you so much, Professor Doug McAdam, our guest this hour. He is the author of Divided: Racial Politics and Social Movements in Postwar America. He's a professor of sociology at Stanford University. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow. No politics, just good conversation analysis of the midterms on Wednesday.